Himalaya.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Professor Is In podcast. I am Dr. Karen Kelski of The Professor Is In.
And I am Kel Weinold, also of The Professor Is In.
And as always, we are very glad that you are here with us today. And can I also say that I just feel incredibly honored that in the middle of this shit show that just seems to intensify with every passing day, that you take some time out of your schedule to join us and hear what we have to say.
And I am extra special excited today. One of the struggles, I think, around all of this that's going on is finding things that are something to look forward to and
right.
Joy.
Yeah.
And I have been looking forward to this for, actually, we've been trying to do this for a couple months. So
yeah.
I've been looking forward to this. But today I'm really excited because we have a guest.
Yes, we do.
And as much as I like to talk to you, love, it's nice to bring in some voices.
Absolutely. So. Especially this one, who we go back a long time with.
Yes.
So very excited to have her here. And I'm going to let you do the introduction.
So today we have with us our friend, Dr. Dina Dart, who is a member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation. She is a principal of Live Oak. She is the principal of Live Oak Consulting. She is a PhD in Anthro and Museum Studies from the University of Oregon. Go Dogs.
And that's where I met her.
Yes, where we met her.
We both met her back in the day.
And I'm just going to say this because I just need to fangirl just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Really one of the leading lights, the people working on decolonizing policy and procedures around working with Native communities and museums.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the exhibitions, but actually the policy about it. And that to me is the
structural change.
Yeah, that's the meat of it. That's awesome. So welcome, Dina.
Thank you both. It's a little odd getting introduced in such a formal way by people I know so well.
I know, it's a little strange, isn't it?
I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be talking with your followers and with you. I've been looking forward to this as well.
Cool. So take some time and tell us a little bit more about what you're doing now.
So let's see. I have been in business for myself, Live Oak Museum Consulting. I'm actually moving to remove the museum from the title because I'm starting to do a lot of work that's not related to museums. But the goal initially was to help museums to connect with Native communities, the communities that they represent, the communities of which they hold ancestral materials. There aren't a lot of people helping museums do this, and so many institutions sort of avoid the work or do it kind of haphazardly because they don't know who to contact or they fear stepping on toes or so having somebody that's sort of a middleman is helpful. And it also from my perspective it enables a sort of a bridge, right, for Native people to start being heard and more accurately and meaningfully represented in these institutions that educate millions of people about our histories and our cultures. So, it started with curating a couple of exhibitions, but it's moved into the development of sort of decolonization policy for several institutions. It's I've done an evaluation of Native arts granting. I still prefer my favorite part of the work is curating exhibitions and you know, elevating Native voices in those spaces. But I'm also doing a lot of these decolonization trainings now, sort of cultural sensitivity and, you know, helping institutions to do some really foundational work. You know, a lot of institutions are doing diversity, equity, and inclusion work, but not very many are looking at the foundations of white supremacy and colonial processes and, you know, in my opinion, institutions on American soil need to be healing the relationships with the indigenous people, who are ancestral to that soil, whose DNA is still in that soil, mm-hmm. And the diversity, equity, and inclusion work is important, but it's sort of superficial if you're not doing that deep foundational work. Yeah. So there's a lot of call for that work, and you can imagine in this political and social climate that the call is greater for that work. So I'm trying to find a way to do some of that work online, and so that it doesn't consume all of my time. Right. It really could consume all of my time.
And you have something you're doing. You are spearheading a national policy change, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple years ago, I actually presented at the Association of Tribal Libraries, Archives, and Museums about how important it is to put some pressure on museums to work with Native communities. There's not currently any mandate to do that, and so museums that hold Native collections don't really there's no reason to consult if they don't feel like it. So what I said at this conference, this national conference, was what we need to do. is create policy that requires museums to work with, if they have Native collections, to work with Native communities in order to become accredited, American Alliance of Museums accredited. It needs to be a accreditation criteria that you be, in dialogue with Native communities if you hold those materials. And I got a standing ovation, and then all these people came up to me afterwards and said, "You need to do this. You need to actually do this."
Yeah.
So
you need
when
to
I
do
got,
this.
So when I got back home, I was actually doing a writing fellowship in Santa Fe at the time at the School for Advanced Research. And I called AAM and talked to a couple different people. And then I was on the phone with this Standards of Excellence, the person that manages their Standards of Excellence and that sort of realm of things. And she said, you should think about reaching out and collaborating with the folks at the School for Advanced Research, Brian Bio at the School for Advanced Research. And I said, well, that's funny. I happen to be about 100 yards from Brian Bio's office at this moment. And Brian Bio and a team of people had just completed a guidelines for museums to work with Native communities around collections. Yeah. So I walked over to his office and we started a conversation about how do we expand these guidelines to reach all facets of the museum. So we're not just talking about collections. We're talking about, the frontline interpreters and the education department and the development people. Wow. That there's a standard of excellence for working with Native people and Native materials that everyone in the museum has to comply with. And so they actually found some money in their budget and contracted with me to spearhead this. And so I now have a committee of Native museum professionals, some of the best in the country. And we have developed this set of standards of excellence, and we're in regular communication with the American Alliance of Museums, and we plan to roll it out in 2021 at their conference. And there's going to be a bunch of publicity, and
that's awesome.
There'll be a session about it, and so something that was just this kind of off the cuff thing that I said, that there were people that kind of made me accountable to doing it, and now it's this real thing, and I've gotten to spend the last 2 years with some of my heroes in the museum field, and we meet regularly in Santa Fe, and it's pretty dreamy.
That is so cool.
Congratulations. That's cool, and I can't wait to see it happen.
Thank you. Yeah, so, it's great to be able to affect the field overall.
Well,
right?
Yes.
Rather than, these sort of ad hoc or one-off projects that make a difference for the people on the ground, right? But having a big policy change like that will have a more, a long-lasting impact on a greater number of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the things, I have many, many follow-ups and comments and queries, 25 things you just said in that last little bit, but I did want to make sure that we gave a few minutes to you telling your post-academic transition story, because I know that's going to speak to many of our listeners, especially now. It always does, but especially now with this kind of financial collapse of higher education and the whole U.S. economy, that many people are considering leaving the academy. Many more people are considering leaving the academy than ever before. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, well, it isn't just, let me reframe it though, sorry, because it isn't just a neutral postdoc. Oh, I didn't like it and I left. I mean, you are an Indigenous woman in the academy. And so how was it for you? Starting either in grad school, if you want to start there, or after, in terms of what led you to, your engagement with cultural anthropology, with museum studies, and, you know, what happened that you ended up saying, no, thank you, I'm going to do something else.
Yeah. So, I mean, you witnessed some of that breakdown, Karen. It was really that quarter that I had that final social theory seminar class that was the turning point for me. But grad school overall was so weird, right? It was so abstract. It was always just so abstract. Mm-hmm. And it actually, an anthropology department for Native people is kind of a hostile environment, right? Mm-hmm. Native people are being studied. Their community is being studied and analyzed and critically examined and written about for, the purpose of other white armchair anthropologists to hypothesize and critique. And it's just really pretty gross, the whole business of it, right? Mm-hmm. But we also recognize that without those credentials, were taken less seriously. And frankly, the reason I came to the University of Oregon was to get a degree to be able to serve my community. Uh-huh. And I mean, I came there as an undergrad to work with John Erlinson, who is an archaeologist, a white archaeologist who had worked for many years, 25 years, for my tribe doing cultural resource management. And the tribe actually decided, we need one of our own to be in his position. We need to stop paying a non-Native archaeologist to run our business. Mm-hmm. And so that's the reason I came to the University of Oregon in the first place. And this commitment to my community that I'm not the only Native person who arrives at college or in grad school with that commitment. Mm-hmm. My commitment was never to educate the world about Native people. It was about bringing these tools back to my own community. But once I'm there, I'm basically told on a daily basis that the real prestige, the real change that can occur can only occur in a university setting. You need to get a tenure track position in order for that to happen, in order for real systemic change to occur. And, mm-hmm. There was a part of me that was afraid that was true. But there was another part of me that felt like the things that I was learning were so abstract. They had no real application. And that on the ground, we have real issues that need to be addressed, that all the hypothesizing that occurs at the university level isn't going to change. Right. We have real needs. There's urgent needs. And So thankfully I found the museum studies department and really felt like those were my people, because those folks are about applying the theory, and crafting it in a way that is accessible to the common folks. And that really appealed to me. And then I started looking at the way that, Native people are represented in the museums to those common folks, right? Those potential allies, and how poorly that's being done. And so I started analyzing that, and that became a real passion, because That does have an on-the-ground impact on us every day. We're a federally non-recognized tribe, and part of the reason for that is that the community around us doesn't even know we exist. Mm. And so we don't have the allies that we could potentially have if the public representations of us were accurate, mm-hmm. And our voices. So that seemed much more compelling to me than a tenure track position where I was going to have to teach these big classes, these intro to Native right. studies or intro to anthropology, God forbid.
Right. Right.
Intro to anthropology.
Kinship.
So there were those things, but then there was also the blatant white supremacy, racism shit that we had to shoulder and face on a daily basis. I mean, you remember in that social theory class, Karen, and there were three Native people in that class, like a critical mass yes. of Native people in that class. And so we were able to be heard, but had there only been one, the heaviness of carrying that message into the class every time is mm-hmm. too much. It's no wonder that Native people drop out in grad school. Mm-hmm. But then to sign myself up for a lifetime of that.
Mm. Right, in that intro to Native America or Native Studies class where you got to hear it all again.
Right, right. Or anthropology, which is even worse, intro to cultural anthropology, yeah. where I'm, oh my gosh, I couldn't have imagined trying to create a syllabus for that class that was full, anyway. So I started thinking about, other ways that I could work in the world. But then I got recruited by the University of Washington, a tenure track position. It was a dual appointment, though. It was tenure track position in either anthropology or American Indian Studies. And then a half-time appointment at the Burke Museum as curator of Native American ethnology. Mm-hmm. And that felt to me like it was going to be a good combination. I'd still have an opportunity to publish about these things that are crucial, but I'd have an opportunity to work with Native communities, work with Native collections, and curate exhibits about these really urgent things like climate change, right? And how Native perspectives can potentially, back us away from the edge of doom. Mm-hmm. So I took that position and I quickly learned that, the role of a person of color at the university is so burdensome mm-hmm. that it wasn't just teaching in I chose American Indian Studies because I knew that the faculty in American Indian Studies was going to be more amenable to the fact that I had a three-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. I know anthropologists. I know that the Department of Anthropology at the University of Oregon was certainly not friendly to the mm-hmm. to women with small children. Right. There's still this really rigorous expectation, right? So, and I was right. The folks in American Indian Studies were amazing, but the expectation to teach, a halftime load and curate exhibitions, as well as publishing yep. and mentoring students. And as soon as the word got out that there was a new Native faculty, you better believe that all of those Native grad students wanted me on their committees,
right.
and all the undergrads wanted to do internships at the Burke Museum with me. And of course, I felt a certain obligation to do that work. And then committees, all the committees that, we need a Native person on this museum studies committee, and we yeah. need we need you to teach in museum studies. And and then I got a big grant to do a cultural exchange between the Ainu in Northern Japan.
Yeah.
It was so fun. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine a big grant like that consumed all of my time. I didn't publish anything. I was, I was barely available for my courses. And so it was insane. I was working 16-hour days and trying to stay connected with the Native communities so that I was a bridge for them to, these resources. And seeing my kid for, 30 minutes a day, as I'm running out the door in the morning. And I got a call after I'd been at the University of Washington for, about 3 years. I got a call from a recruiter from the Portland Art Museum, offering me a 40-hour a week job for a higher salary, that didn't require any kind of publishing or the rigors of, teaching and developing
just
courses.
One job instead of three.
Just one job. Yep.
And
back into Oregon where, my daughter's dad's whole family is. So we moved back and I haven't had a single regret. I mean, there are times when I go to the, AAA meetings and, because those folks are still my colleagues and I hear about the things that they're doing and there's a little twinge of, of envy, but I sure don't miss the lifestyle, having to conform. And now that I work for myself, I don't have to conform to the museum environment either. Mm-hmm. And, the white supremacist foundations of that institution either. I get to come and go and make my own hours and make my own rules, so anyway, that was a really long-winded answer.
That was an amazing answer. Thank you so much. And may I take this opportunity, Dina, I feel I need to make amends to you for any role that I played in that message that applied work was second best, because I know I believe that. I absolutely believe that. I believe that most of the way through my actual career. I don't know that I stopped believing it until I left the academy. That's how strong that belief was, that I couldn't think around it. And I remember being very judgy about, because there was always at the U of O Anthro department, there was definitely a block of people who did have some level of commitment to applied work. I can't think of details right now or people or whatever, but I know there was a little bit of energy around it. And I was just very judgy about it. And I was like, well, that's just And so if I played any role in that, which I think obviously I did.
I was going to say, is there an answer?
There really is really a conditional.
I believe I knew you then.
There was no if. I just want to apologize for that, because I was just not doing my best work as an advisor at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. There was so much to it. I mean, it's just so embedded in the culture, right? So it wasn't even really the individuals as much as the just the sort of overall expectation, right? Everywhere. And that expectation that gets put on the grad students of color as well. So we just automatically feel like we're less. Then we're less important, we're less valid, we're already sort of at a disadvantage because we're less apt to already buy these theories. I mean, I remember that social theory class and being so envious of Patrick because he could freaking quote Foucault and give examples of how that theory, applied to his daily life as a white male grad student. But, I always felt like an outsider,
right?
Because of that. I always felt less than. Yeah. And so I was already at a disadvantage. And then the fact that I wanted to do something that was seen as less prestigious was hard. It was hard to hold on to. It was like, we already have that internalized racism come from the gate, and then we come into an environment like that validates that over and over again. I remember somebody in that class too, at one point saying that, because I, because I had a modern hair clip that I'm not completely traditional or something. I mean, it was the most ignorant. I remember looking at that person like they had three heads. Like, are you kidding me? You're in, you know, how did you arrive at this place? You know, that because I use a cell phone and because I participate in modern American life, that I am somehow not fully, truly Indian, you know, and I just remember wanting to sock that person in the head and then run screaming from that room. What is the point of this? If this person who has, you know, achieved this level of, you know, training is asking me such a ridiculous question, am I going to spend the rest of my life in front of classrooms of that kind of ignorance? Yeah. People questioning my identity because I don't look the way that they've been taught I'm supposed to look. Yeah. Man.
Anything to undermine and delegitimize and sideline and just to you and I, well, Kel wants to say something, but I feel the need to say this right now, is that our listeners don't know the context of this was a class on social theory in anthropology, graduate seminar, advanced graduate seminar on social theory in anthropology. And so I was teaching it, and that was the context for all of this. And I want to share one more piece of, I want to share that Dina, you and the other students of color in that class basically said, hold up. What is this syllabus that we're reading? And everybody on this syllabus is white. And what the hell, Karen? And I remember, and I'm sure your take on this will be different from mine. So please feel free to fill in. But I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I just assigned a syllabus for social theory that was all white. Like, what am I doing? I supposedly have these commitments. I completely failed to walk the walk. And so then I did make efforts. I made the best efforts that I was could conceive of at that time. I'm sure they were totally inadequate, in truth. But in any case, to revise the syllabus, to change the readings, which I remember prompted enormous chaos, because like we never knew what we were reading from one week to the next because I was constantly changing my mind. But anyway, and then asking people to suggest readings and so on and so forth, and then the class itself in the meetings became kind of contentious at different moments because the white students got really up in arms about it. And the reason I'm going into all this for our listeners is because I actually have a reason. And that is that a couple of the white students then went to the department head. And
I didn't know that.
You didn't? I didn't tell you this. So. Oh my God.
It's a long time.
Yeah. Anyway, they went to Lynn Stephen, the department head, and said, and I'm naming her for a reason, because she was great. And so I want to give her full credit for that, because they said, this is a hostile environment for white people. And we don't like the way Karen's teaching this class. And to her credit, Lynn said, yeah, sucks to be you. I guess, think maybe, I don't know exactly what Lynn said, but she was basically like, yeah, I'm not listening to this. Go back to class and deal with it. And probably also, you know, if this is hard for you, think about how hard all the rest of the classes are to students of color. And so they were not able to sabotage my teaching in this case, but that is really an exception. I think that in the majority of cases, department heads would not side with anything that was critical of the canon of anthropology.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to share that because I think people are out there, our listeners are out there in departments where none of this, you know, these things are happening and turning out probably quite differently.
Yeah, I do remember through the court, through that 10 weeks, what was it called? The grad lounge was a pretty hostile environment for Diane and I. Every time we'd walk in there, it would get completely quiet. Right. I mean, like everybody would be talking and in raised voices too. And then we'd walk in and it would get hushed. Nobody would talk. And I also remember one of the exercises. It was life-changing for the Native people, I know for sure. Being in that environment, feeling supported within that environment to just keep sort of vocalizing, mm-hmm. Our outrage. Mm-hmm. But I remember one of the exercises that Diane did when she had to lead the discussion. She came in and she made everybody get up and move. And she was yelling in Paiute at them and basically telling them, non-verbally, but telling them to get up and move to another seat and to get their stuff and move to another seat. And it's, that's 9 o'clock in the morning and people are drinking their coffee and like, what the hell's going on? This Native woman comes in yelling and she's speaking in a language they don't understand. And she starts writing in Paiute on the chalkboard and she's still yelling at them. And then she stops and says, imagine what it was like being, told that you had to leave all you had to do was pick up your backpack and your coffee, but we had to leave our homes of thousands of years and move to another place. And, what about when they came in and took our children and, yes. and I remember a couple of the white women crying crying. Later, right. I can picture the one right now. Yeah. I don't want to name her by name, but I shouldn't be subject to this. This is, this is unfair. Why am I being subject to this? That was a contentious semester. And I applaud you, Karen, for staying the course with us, and all of us, you remember when we all got together and had a little party at the end of the quarter and everybody, we came through it, we came through it as a unit and everybody learned something anyway.
It changed my life. It was an inflection point in my life. No question about it. In terms of how I think about, everything, as a white person of what am I doing and what am I saying and who's listening and what are the impacts of my words and my actions and my teaching and anthropology anyway. Mm-hmm. But Kel, what were you going to say?
I was actually, and it relates to this, that I wanted to hit a big pause button because I wanted, and this is great that it actually waited for me to say this until after this class, because this class was stunning. So just to put a little bit more context, I was a faculty member at the University of Oregon in journalism and got a wild idea that I needed to take a social theory class, that I had not taken this type of social theory class. And I got this idea that in a free hour of my time, or 3 hours or however many it was, I was just going to take a social theory class. And this is the class I landed in. And it was phenomenal. And so I wasn't an anthropologist. I was a journalist. I wasn't attached to the discipline. And I was considerably older than everyone else. So it was phenomenal. I mean, I learned.
Not everyone else.
Not everyone, but a lot of the people. Right. Not everyone else. Sorry, not everyone else. So, but certainly older than Patrick. So,
Bless his heart.
So, but what I wanted to do is I just wanted to, I think sometimes it's really important that we just pause and let things sink in. And I want it to sink in for people listening what your tenure track job experience was, because it's that graduate school experience of demanded so much of, expectations outsized, bringing all of your understanding into a place that is hostile to your understanding, and then take that into a job where then you become responsible, not just for your job, but you become responsible for undergraduates and graduates, and you're a representative of everything, and you're supposed to emotionally support everyone, and you have the museum studies and the committees. And I think we talk about this all the time on podcasts about the additional labor for faculty of color. But I think every time we hear clear examples of it, I just want everybody to I just want a pause button and say, sit with it for a minute, especially those of you who are white on the tenure track mm-hmm. and are feel like you're drinking from a fire hose. And I know that you do.
Right.
Your first and second and third years, you mm-hmm. you cannot fathom before you get the job how overwhelmed you're going to be. You get it. You're overwhelmed. Now just notice what your colleagues around you are going through.
Colleagues of color.
Colleagues of color are going through. So I just wanted, I just didn't want to blow
totally
past that
unequal.
Experience, Dina, because it was so what you imagine. I mean, in a way, like, I don't want to be a part of that. Okay, well, I got this job. I'll try it. Oh, shit. It really is this. but we can, I don't know. They just get written in as this, like, and then it's like, no. Wait, let's just sit there for a minute.
Yeah. So.
Well, I would add too, Kel, that, that the expectations on people of color in all areas are greater.
Yes.
Because, so I went to this position at the Portland Art Museum, mm-hmm. Assuming that the responsibilities, the burden would be less because I didn't, you know, have to teach classes. I don't have to, you know, I don't have a tenure track. I'm just to manage this collection and connect the collection with the communities, blah, blah. However, the sense of responsibility for especially a Native curator managing or stewarding a Native collection is so intense, because here are these ancestral materials that have been stolen in many cases out of the hands of the people who you know cared for them, and they're essentially their ancestors, right? And so here's this collection of grieving ancestors that have been ripped away from their children and grandchildren that I'm in charge of, right? And no other curator in that institution had that emotional, spiritual, and frankly intellectual burden of caring for their collection, mm-hmm. right? And in most cases, they're dealing with single artists or single donors that are donating, you know, individual works or whatever. And here I was the conduit to all of these communities, and as well as the historic communities, right? So communities represented from all of North America and all through time, right? So at one point, the director of the museum said, "I understand your burden. It's just like how I am accountable to the donor whose name is on the gallery that holds your materials. Like, generations of that family I'm accountable to, and so I understand your burden." Mm-hmm. And in that moment I was like, I need to go. This person doesn't have any concept. Mm-hmm. So you know, he spoke to me and expected of me the same as any of the other curators who had none of that kind of emotional and spiritual sense of responsibility. And so partly why I'm doing what I'm doing is to try to create some space for those Native curators in those institutions that are up against that, right? Yeah. That at least if I can come in and give their colleagues some language and some, you know, an avenue towards sensitivity and understanding of the burden that they're carrying, then perhaps they don't have to do it alone. Mm-hmm. But you know, as a young, you know, post grad, I went into the world of academia and museums rather naive. I mean, even though I had that experience in grad school, I still was optimistic about the change I could make and all of that. And it has the capacity to just really smother those, you know, that light. Mm-hmm. And it did when I was at the Portland Art Museum. I was just fighting all the time. Mm-hmm. And of course there are allies there. There are always allies and supporters, but it just becomes too much. And I find that even in the work that I do now, I have to be really good about setting boundaries, because people want so much of you, you know. It's just you are all of a sudden their link to Native people, you know, and they want to know about Native people. So they just start mining you, you know, right. And I mean, even that's people in my personal life, it happens all the time, and I have to be really careful, or I find myself horizontal for days, not answering the phone, you know, because I just need to restore my spirit. You know, I'm a whole human being. I'm not just their conduit to the Native American world, you know? So, yeah. Anyway, so I would ask your listeners to also consider that, you know, we're doing the best we can, and with all kinds of life circumstances, just like white folks are,
but more so.
We have a greater sense of responsibility, oftentimes, to our communities and to the ancestors. You know, that's something that's a cultural difference,
sure.
And with that cultural difference comes a pretty heavy burden, and you know, having to be connected with my community, it gives me great joy to be connected with them. But there's also a burden.
Right.
I get to do a language class now on Zoom. So I'm learning the Smoowich language, which is so amazing. It's so great to see all these faces and to hear them speak in our language. And I love that I get to be a part of that now. But last week I got a call from our tribal chair and a couple other people in the department at one of the Chumash organizations for me to help them with the removal of a plaque, a really racist plaque in Santa Barbara. And there was a board of supervisors meeting that was going to occur in 2 hours, and we needed to ready ourselves with our statement for that, because nobody told us about the board of supervisors. We found out inadvertently. Mm. And so we were just going to show up digitally to this board of supervisors meeting and tell them what they need to replace it with and how it needs to go. Like, you don't just get to sweep it away in the middle of the night because you know it's going to cause a ruckus,
right.
In this social climate. We want to be in charge of what it's replaced with and how that goes. And so we spent 2 hours on the phone, and then the other four women actually participated in the 3-hour board of supervisors meeting. But so those are the kinds of things, they just come up and you got to be ready.
Right, you got to be ready to deal with it.
And with a PhD, and you know, any of your listeners, you know, postdoc listeners of color, know that once you have a PhD, your community sees you as a really important resource, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you become really busy. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, this is just terrible, but because I have like 85 more things I want to talk to you about, but we are, I know you have to go, and I want to respect your time. And I want to, I had a question, but it just left at my complete despondency at the time being up.
Maybe we can do a part two. Maybe we can do Dina's a part two.
Oh, I know what I wanted to say. I wanted to say, Dina, thank you for something that you illustrated that I want people to pay attention to, is that you were standing up in front of a crowd and said, this needs to happen. And out of that, a whole bunch of things occurred and wheels turned and you did amazing work and something significant is going to happen. So those of you out there who are disenchanted with the Academy, who are find yourself stomping your foot or banging a table or just, you know, lying awake at night saying this needs to happen, there is a possibility for you to engage in that kind of change. And you see a perfect example of it here.
It's so true, Kel. Thanks for reiterating that. And also that as a result of doing it and standing in that brave space, I also got paid to do it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We love that. Right.
We're all about that. That's awesome.
So, yeah. Anyway, it's been delightful talking with you guys.
Yeah, it's really nice. Dina, on the subject of money, is there a organization that you would like to ask our listeners to donate to if they want to support the work you're doing or the Chumash Nation?
Well, that's lovely. There is, You know, what I would rather people do mm-hmm. is to find out who the local native people are that are indigenous to the land that they currently live on mm-hmm. and find a way to support those mm-hmm. folks. That's really important. And it also takes that extra step of, you know, learning who are the indigenous people of that land. And there's the Native Land app that was produced by a Canadian organization, and they can download it and they can see, you know, who are the indigenous people of that land, and then Google, where do the Shawnee live, mm-hmm. And then donate, and especially if the tribe is non-federally recognized and struggling with federal recognition. Like if you're in Portland, the Chinook Nation actually has a place on their website where you can donate, you can pay rent. And many tribes are starting to do that. Oh, so I great. Would recommend that. But thank you for putting that option out there.
Cool. Thank you.
All right.
And if you have more questions, you can have me back.
Absolutely, yeah. We will.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dina.
All right, you guys. All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.